For 1 week and 1 week only, men are invited onto Radio Gorgeous. Welcome to Man Week.
I'm just an old-fashioned girl with an old-fashioned mind. Not sophisticated, I'm the plain and simple kind. I want an old-fashioned house with an old-fashioned fence and an old-fashioned...
This week is Man Week on Radio Gorgeous, and today I'm very excited to have on a man who's worked in academia for over a decade, lecturing and teaching. Before that, he worked in the Met Police in London, then he became a property developer. He's also an inventor, as he designed and produced a motor catamaran. Most recently, through no fault of his own, went from being a millionaire to a homeless bankrupt in a matter of weeks when the banking crisis hit in 2008. It was the last experience which gave him the time and motivation to use his earlier research as his basis upon what to create his book, Tale of a Tigress, Views on the Road to Gender Equality. He is David Devere, and welcome to Radio Gorgeous, David.
Thank you for asking me here. It's a pleasure.
So, hi, welcome. You come all the way from Bournemouth today to talk about your book. How did this book come about?
It started with those conversations you have in a kitchen where you sit down with a cup of coffee and talk about this, that and the other. And I always felt more comfortable talking to women about that sort of thing than I did being with a beer in my hand talking about football or golf. And I found so many aspects of women's life so interesting and in some ways positive, but in other ways sad.
So... the title, Tale of a Tigress, what does that mean?
Well, I see women as potentially being a tigress, being the true ruler of life's jungle, but unfortunately not all women see themselves in that role. If someone wants to put down women, the best people at it seem to be women.
Oh, very interesting. Now, the tale of the tigress, why the tail? Why not the whole body?
Because it's a double entendre on a... tale about women and their gaining the power, but also right at the end of the book there is a little chapter that talks about a story of the tale of the tigress, which basically says if you grab the tail of the tigress and it's in your hands, it's up to you whether you let go and let it run away or whether you hang on to it and ride with it, and that's what you can do with the information in the book.
Fantastic. So do you see women as killing carnivores like the tigress?
No, not in that way. I mean, they obviously have the potential to be, but I just think they are far more powerful than a lot of them ever realise. And it's sad that those that don't realise don't.
Well, I think man comes from the womb and spends his life trying to get back in it, basically.
Yes, but you see, man comes from the womb of a woman, and all the time that she knows she's pregnant, she's having a conversation with the child, be it male or female. That continues till the child is born, and then it becomes real at that point, or certainly more real, and that bond just grows and grows and grows until they go to perhaps junior school, where they're going to be taught by women until they're about 11. And so women have total control over little boys and making them into men. And then they don't like what men, boys have grown into. And let's face it, men are only boys that grew up.
So do you think women could be more aware of this and sort of help guide boys better?
It is certainly possible. This is why I think, with the book, I haven't tried to draw any conclusions. I've just put lots of information there and asked lots of questions. It's a bit like when you get those school exam papers that say, discuss. It's that sort of thing, because at the moment I just don't see any answers. And different people have very different perspectives. So
now that's what I want to talk about, because you interviewed over 100 women. Can you tell us about their different backgrounds? And who were they?
They varied very considerably. When I started this, it was just anyone that I came into contact with socially. And then sort of... word spread that I was interested in this. And then not a lot happened other than these social gatherings until after the internet had become such a strong thing that it is and that I'd learned to use it. And I was then able to go back and talk to more women. And when things went pear-shaped in 2008, and I had the... I was given an opportunity that I wasn't looking for, but I decided to use it. And as I did a lot more research and talked to people, the word spread that I was doing something positive with it, and lots of women wanted to speak to me.
Now, what sort of questions did you ask the women? And how long did it take a talk with them?
Well, most of them were ongoing. They were people that I preferred to see more than one time. Originally, I did do a questionnaire, thinking that women would rather do that in the privacy of their own homes and with anonymity. But in fact, most of them were very happy to talk to me, as I say, over a cup of coffee in at a kitchen table. And yes, I was honoured by the way they spoke and what they spoke about. And these women range from a lady that was brought up in a very grand house in the countryside to someone that was a dinner lady. I mean, literally everyone.
What about different races?
I didn't get that much from different races. I did get people who were brought up in different countries, and I also got to speak to a few gay men and lesbian women as well to get a different perspective. Mm. But yes, it was very interesting, and there were some things that were common, but a lot of diversity.
Okay, what was the common thread that women had?
I think, as far as the book is concerned, most directly, I think most women believed in the theory of having equality, but they didn't quite know what they wanted from equality. I think there was a confusion between equality, feminism, and equality of opportunity. And in truth, when you talk to them, what they want was equality of opportunity, but only when they want it, because other things have a higher priority in their lives.
That sounds about right. I think the thing that we have that's a luxury over men is we have more choice. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, choice has altered slightly for men these days. I know when I was at school, we were brought up with the thought that you left school, became qualified, took a job, and you would stay in that job until you were 65, at which point you would retire and die 2 years later. Now that has gone. But then women's lives have changed. At that same time, the chores for a woman in a house were horrendous.
Every day they had a job to do. Monday was washing, Tuesday was ironing, Wednesday was cleaning, Thursday, yeah.
Absolutely, and shopping wasn't going to a supermarket. No. It was trudging around town in the wet and the wind.
Every day.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you couldn't always afford a refrigerator, so you had to keep things fresh in a little box with holes in it for the wind to blow through, or go to the shops daily to make sure stuff was fresh. Mm. And we forget that's within a generation.
Mm. And you think about how much time that took. I mean, now we've even got time to look at the internet. Just think, these women would... Did they even get time to kind of read a Penny Dreadful? You know what I mean? I mean, it's like they had no leisure time, did they?
Absolutely. Mm. Because also, if you go back before the end of the First World War, things were very different then. Because since then, we have had the state as a safety net. And then since the 60s, we've had a few more things helping. And the other thing we had at the end of the war was to have things like antibiotics, which made a tremendous difference to men and women. I mean, the number of women that died in childbirth was astounding.
Wasn't it one in two or something? Or was it not that high?
It wasn't actually that high. One in two children used to. They reckoned that most women were pregnant most of their reproductive lives because of the number of children they lost.
Yes, because both my grandparents lost a child each. So they're the average, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. Mine also. Yes, and it's the sort of thing we forget about. If you said to people now, when you're poorly, when you've got a cut and it's turned septic, no, there isn't anything to put on it, try some honey. They will be shocked. But that was the reality before the end of the Second World War.
So you're saying that people had, in a way, life was such hard work... That, you know, women had to do housework. Someone had to do housework. Yeah. And it just happened to be women, because women had children, I suppose. That's what happened. And but during both wars, women did have a chance to do male jobs. And that's when feminism really began, wouldn't you say?
Yes, that's... war does two things. It gives women the opportunity to have a taster, if you like, of men's jobs, though under an awful lot of pressure. And... it also moves technology on. I mean, one of my heroines from the First World War period was a lady called Dorothy Pullinger, who was born to a French mother, an English father, that lived in France, north of France, towards the end of the 19th century, came to Scotland, where he was the MD of a small car company, and she was to become a draftsperson in that company. When the First World War started, she went to the northeast and was in charge of a factory that had been converted to create armaments, and they worked so well there that at the end of the war she got an MBE. Now, while she was doing this, she had realised that more and more women were driving, in particular ambulances, and she could see that the cars that she had been used to her father's factory producing were not really that suitable. So when she went back to that factory, she had a design for a car specifically for women. It was smaller, lighter, had more storage, even had something called a rear view mirror. Most of the people making it were women. And one of the things I think is great is that the female apprentices were so good at their apprenticeships that the authorities dropped the time limit for it from 5 years down to 3 years.
I've never heard that story.
Yes, Dorothy Pullinger is one of my heroines, and she, like most of this, is all in the book.
So she's a designer, inventor, innovator, promoter of women, a feminist.
Yeah. Absolutely. It was only when the financial world turned inside out in the 1930s that company went bust, and it didn't happen. I mean, she even raced some of these cars, so she was quite a lady.
Yeah, brilliant. Now, I want to say that I've interviewed a lot of women, obviously, being on Radio Gorgeous, and most people say that feminism is about equality of pay is usually the first thing that we're looking for. What things did you find out about women and pay?
Yes, I think it depends on the age group you're talking to. For those who are the mothers of young women that are starting work, they want them to get equality of pay and equality of the opportunity to start a job. And those same young women, they want it, they demand it now. And in fact, in many cases, that is not only do we have parity, there are some cases where women are getting more. And we have cases like there are more women GPs than male GPs now. And
all women, 98% of vets are women.
Yes, absolutely. And the universities are now quite worried about the small number of young males going to university and doing well. So things are changing a lot. And the strange thing is that to get these things to change, most has come through Acts of Parliament, which has meant women lobbying the men in Parliament, and those men have changed the law, which I think is amazing. If you go back a century, the men would have, as they did on many occasions, said yes and done nothing.
So do you think men are becoming more feminist?
I think some of them are, certainly those in political positions, because they feel there is a pressure to do that. It is not a good position to say that you are anti-feminist, just like it's not a good position to say you are racist, which is a good thing. But certainly talking to the few men that I was able to talk to, there were an awful lot who privately admitted to paying lip service to feminism when they were in the social situation where it was necessary, but in their hearts weren't really that sure about it, because they knew they were going to lose.
Right. But shouldn't we not see it as a battle? Shouldn't we just see it as equality? I mean, just like, you know, we're in a partnership together. It's like, you know, say if you're in a business partnership, why can't we think, you're best at that job, I'm best at this job, let's divide our role, your chores, let's pool our money together, let's have an equal partnership. Isn't that what everybody wants?
That is, yes, I'm in total agreement with you there. That to me seems like the logic, but I don't see it as my position to say that's how it should be. I think the thing is, we need to have lots of open debate, and it needs to be the sort of debate where people aren't scared about saying things one way or the other and getting the information in front of them. And that's principally why I wrote the book, because so many women said, look, there are a number of things that I am interested in, but I haven't been able to find out more about them because I don't have the time to be able to sit and do it. I mean, this book took me 5 years of full-time writing to get it all together. And no one else is likely to be in a position to do that. And for instance, when you talk about this thing with feminism, and we've spoken about equality and equality of opportunity, there are a small number of media savvy, well-educated women who are urban, urbane, London-centric, who have a very strong feminist voice. And talking to most of the women, they found them quite scary, and they didn't want to be associated with that sort of feeling.
That's really strange, because when I first started Radio Gorgeous, I mean, people who say to me, are you a feminist? And I didn't really know what the word meant, you know, and that was about 6 years ago. And I'd come from living actually in Dorset. I'm not from Dorset, I'm from Yorkshire, but I hadn't lived in London for 12 years. Came back, and now I've realised I am a feminist, because feminist is all she's saying is what I said earlier. It's all we want is equality and respect, which is a human right. And I did the word feminist did scare me, and now I completely have reclaimed it in the last 5 years. I've joined the Women's Equality Party because I just think women, why not? I mean, we are, you know, be brave women. Don't be scared of the word feminism. I think they're thinking back to the scary feminists that used to wear dungarees, hairy armpits, no makeup, you know, and we've moved on from that. You know, we are now, we can be glamorous, we can be intelligent, we can be educated, like you say.
I think a lot of women still have that sort of image foremost. And the few people that you see that actually get an airing in the media tend to be more that way. And they're also pushing a particular theme, if you like, a bit like when politicians are talking, whatever
the
question
saying is equality. That's all they're saying.
Well, some of them are looking at particular aspects of it.
Okay, and tell me what.
And some of them are looking at.
Tell me the aspect that annoys you. Then obviously.
It doesn't annoy me. Okay. The one that annoys women is that a lot of the feminists they believe want to try and live without men, and most of these women are very happy.
Oh, so the thing is the anti-men brigade, that's what you're talking about.
And the fact that they're these women, from their speech to their intended actions, are aggressive. And women, certainly these women I spoke to, are not that way.
I suppose we needed, though, if we look at the Emily Pankhurst, we look at the activists. It's like you need the activists to have persuaded the politicians to have made things good for the people that aren't activists. So in a way, the aggressive women needed to be there, and maybe still need to be there, to make change. And we've got to have those women to, otherwise, if everyone was like easygoing about it, what would have ever happened?
Yes, this is a bit of a dichotomy, and it's always been there. I mean, in the Pankhurst family, there was a lot of infighting on the two angles as to whether you go for a pacifist approach to feminism or whether you use more aggressive tactics. And I mean, they had such problems that the youngest daughter, Adele, was actually given a one-way ticket to Australia by her mother and told to get out of the country. And Sylvia and Christabel were on different sides. Christabel was more the right wing and far more activist, and she thought that they needed strong, educated, wealthy women, whereas her sister thought and could see that if it were to come about, it would be the poorer women who would benefit, but she didn't want to get involved with all this radical activism. And so they split, and Christabel tried to get Sylvia banned from the party. So that was happening within the Pankhurst. Yeah. And people don't talk about this.
Yeah. But then that's political drama, which, I mean, you know, if you look at any family now, if you look at the Johnsons, for example, as in Boris Johnson, his sister just come out as a liberal. I mean, you know, this is passionate, intelligent people will fall out about intellectual problems. Now, one of the first things we say that female babies survive over male babies. Can you tell us the statistics?
I can't pull them off the top of my head. They're in the book, but generally speaking, female babies are far in advance of male babies in all sorts of things, and they have a stronger, their whole body, not only the physical structure, but the way it deals with disease, etc., is much stronger. just in the same
why
way.
Why has nature done this?
Who knows why nature's done it? It's they think it's to do with the chromosomes and the fact that women, by having the two X's, have a spare, if you like, so you can take some damage and collateral, and you've still got a second. Exactly the same happens in the female brain. So, for instance, if you look at the female brain, there are two parts that deal with language, whereas males have one part. So, and women's brains have a lot of what's called white matter, which is the interconnecting tissue. So when a woman thinks about something, it can flash across to these different areas and say, do we know about that? What do we know about? You know, what do we think about that? And this is flashing backwards and forwards. And exactly the same thing is happening with their language, which is, it's like having a built-in spell checker, if you like. And so if you look at young female babies, they have more language, they use more words, they look at faces when people are talking, whereas the boys have fewer, they don't look at faces, they look at things. So there are lots of differences, and this has all come out in the last few decades, this research.
Do you think it's to do with we need to make more emotional attachments, so we need to be able to look more and read people more?
I don't know how one would do that, because one of the things we've found out, and I start the book fairly early on with quite a long thing about our history. If you go back, our history was such that the male was the person that was either fighting or hunting. And to do that, he was usually alone, and he needed to be quiet to be able to get near the prey.
Not to have too many thoughts, in a way. Singular thoughts.
Absolutely.
He was a bit linear, didn't he?
Absolutely. Mm. It was one thing after another.
Yeah.
Whereas the female is the person that was in the position to perhaps be looking after a number of children,
at least, yeah.
Be looking after where the food was coming. And yeah. If you think of it being, in those days, berries, for instance, you're looking all over the place, so you're multitasking there. And at the same time, if the male was away, you were also worrying about safety.
And now, you're also looking after the grandparents as well, and, you know, the whole community. Yeah.
So she was multitasking. This is obviously, no one can say this is exactly how it was, because we can't look at the brain of someone from that era. But we can say that from what we know about how the brain works now, that is likely to have caused the brains to be different. And the male brain, although it's physically larger than the female brain, size for size, the inside is different. The male has more of the cortex, the grey pinky bit you see usually on television of the outside of the brain. Men have more of that, and that's great for this linear thinking, whereas women have this network of the white matter, which interconnects. If you give them the same problem and give them limited parameters in which they can solve it, men and women come to the same conclusion. The difference is the bits of the brain that are active in solving it. If you give them a problem and leave it open, they come to different conclusions because of the way the brain works. Now, that is sort of interesting to look back and say, yes, now we understand why the brain is like it is, because we've been like this way for thousands and thousands of years. And that's why in that period you could go from one century to another and you would fit in perfectly well. Whereas if you took someone from this century and put them back a century, they wouldn't fit in. Well, what we know now is that whilst this is going on, that, for instance, if you took someone doing weightlifting and someone else doing gymnastics, as they're doing that, the body is sending messages to the brain and the brain is sending it back. And just as the muscles will get stronger as that's going on, the pathways also get stronger. So if the theory goes that if you can change people's thoughts, the way they think about gender equality, and that is reinforced and reinforced, those pathways will become stronger and it will become a more natural part of our being. But we're fighting against thousands of years of history.
Now, that's what I want to talk about. What historically have you found out? How long have women been repressed?
I think the simplest two words are forever. Because I've been doing this, I've had a very close perspective of how women have been, and one can see why they've been this way. You can see that the jobs had to be done in those days. Things were so different.
They were physical.
Yes, we talked to how it was sort of earlier this century. Mm. Well, if you go back for that, it was much worse. We didn't even have decent soaps. We didn't, you know, we didn't have hot water. All the things, even our housing was incredibly basic. Mm. Childbirth, the chance of dying of childbirth in those days was horrendous. We didn't know a thing about it.
That's probably why women, babies are stronger. We had to survive.
Absolutely. And that happens in nature. Mm. Whereas for the male, essentially, his main things were to protect and to fight and to be able to procreate.
Yeah.
And that was it. And, you know, that fighting was terrible. I mean, you imagine someone, you know, we now see people on a Saturday night at either end of a bar where they're sort of metaphorically drawing daggers. Well, the reality was, if you go back hundreds, thousands of years, that's what happened. And we see these lovely pictures of knights with armour and shields and swords. They were the knights. We haven't got many knights then, though. Now, there were far fewer then. That the average person just had a pointy stick and they had to stand one side of a football field away from another group of men with those and know that they stood a good chance of dying. If they were injured, they were probably going to get septicemia or bleed to death or something. And if they did survive it, the chances were they'd go somewhere else and they'd have to do it all again. I mean, what...
So it's about survival, wasn't it?
Exactly, for everyone, for male and female. Mm-hmm. And I think initially they knew about that. But because men...
But we don't know that women were repressed in those societies, do we?
I think at that stage perhaps they weren't, but it tended to be because the males had more time to themselves and theoretically more time to think, and they were physically more powerful, I believe that they could impose their will more easily. And for the women, quite frankly, she was running around in ever-decreasing circles and probably thinking, yes, dear, whatever you say, I've got to change a nappy over here, feed this one, do that. And that has just continued.
And then also, when we became settlers, which became sort of Iron Age or whatever, you know, those times, then men started to own things. And I think once we started to trade, then maybe women could be traded.
I think this probably happened very, very early on, because one of the great booties of war wasn't just gold and objects, it was people. And whoever started that and however that started, we don't quite know. We imagine that it was a way of getting people to do the hard work in your society, if possible. We know that the most famous group we think of are the Romans and their slaves. I mean, the Romans had English slaves. I mean, Atticus actually talks in one of his letters, which again I quote in the book, where he's talking to someone else about the slave he has from England, and he says, you'll find those slaves are not very educated.
They're also not very good at serving. As we know, yes, the English are the worst waiters and waitresses in the world.
And then, and then they wonder why they don't get tipped.
So
that sort of thing went on, and that must have created a mentality. And we have to remember that there were very few people that were in charge, very, very many people that were slaves.
Yes,
and
so it's mostly kind of royalty or slaves, wasn't it?
Yes,
there was no
absolutely
middle class. You were either living in a hovel, living in a castle, and 0.5% lived in the castle.
Absolutely. Yeah. There were a few hangers-on in the middle who used to...
Sucked up at court.
Exactly. And so that happened. And I think because that was there... I mean, for instance, you couldn't in those days... You weren't even allowed to leave your village without permission from your liege. And anyone that came into a village that you didn't know, they were immediately identified as being very strange. And that was the only reality you knew. You know, you didn't turn on the television and radio and see what was happening in Africa. You didn't know what was happening in the next village. And so that was the only reality. And I think because people were brought up with that, they saw subservience and being enslaved as being sort of natural. And serfs were only really, I mean, the word serf comes from the same base as slave. Mm. And they were only a step beyond slaves. Mm. You know, it was...
Mm. So actually the men were slaves and the women were slaves.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. In fact, most slaves in Roman times, the majority were male. They particularly liked the young males.
Oh, yeah.
Well, for sexual favours, yes.
Yeah, as well.
But also because strong. They were strong and able to work. I mean, Rome had some amazing engineering, but most of it wasn't done by the Romans. It might have been designed by them, but it wasn't done by them. And again, I have quite a bit in the book talking about. And that, back to this thing of how things you do create what happens in the mind. This is what has happened and this is what we're fighting against.
Have you found any societies when women do, you know, are in charge? Like there are some obscure places in Papua New Guinea, aren't there, and things? You
know? Yes. And again, I have some of those in. But one of the ones that comes up frequently, and it's a name that everyone sort of knows, is the Amazons. Now, everyone always used to think that the Amazons were just designs on jugs and things from the Greco-Roman times, and that these women warriors didn't really exist. But then fairly recently, the Russians and the Americans, these archaeologists went off and had an expedition in sort of to the northeast of Greece, and they have actually found that these women existed. They found burial sites, quite a lot of them. These women are buried with their horses. They are tattooed. They are strong. Mm. They have bows and arrows. They have axes. Mm. They used to do hot tenting for drugs. Wow. They wore shorts, which is the first time that's ever seen. So there are groups like that around, and that carries on right through to the Dahomey in Africa.
Well, I even know that people in Victorian times, women, especially gay women, would hide, you know, pretend that they were men and join the war. You know, there's always in society been eccentric people who've gone and done exactly what they want.
That's right. Back in the English Civil War, there was a woman who her husband was going to battle for the king. She was a royalist too and wanted to support, so she wore armour and went to fight in the battle with her brother. They lost very badly, but they survived. They got back to their castle, and they knew that they were going to be sought out by Cromwell and his men. And in fact, it was Cromwell himself that came to the castle, because it was the nearest place to rest up, and he thought he might find this man. Well, the brother hid in the priest hole, but the woman, she climbed out of her armour and dressed as a woman. So when he arrived there, looking for sustenance and for her brother, he had no idea that she'd actually been fighting against him in the battle. And she got named by the locals Trooper Jane, because she sat there armed in front of him, theoretically protecting him and also her dignity until the next morning, when he had slept, had some food, and he went off and they never found his brother. So there have been people all the way through.
Also, I call it herstory, not history. So it's like, also, men have written history, so they've always written about men. You know, women weren't given the education, but women, I think, have always... I do believe that women have always been doing interesting things. How could they not be? Because we are interesting. We're fascinating, aren't we?
Yes, I think one of the earliest ones I go back to is King John's daughter, Eleanor. She had a very interesting life. She was married when she was 9, which was... I mean, 12 was quite usual in those days. King John was married when he was 12. A brother married a girl of 12. It was quite natural. And in fact, she had such a wonderful relationship with her husband for just 6 years that by the time she was 15, he died. And she was so heartbroken that she took a vow of celibacy. But sometime afterwards, she decided that actually the hormones were working a bit too strongly and she'd like another man. So there was a big hoo-ha went on about having to go to the Pope and get permission, and they had to pay for that. And in the meantime, she should have inherited the money that was her husband's, but there were people, mainly his family, that were trying to stop her do that. And she spent her entire life trying to get back the money that she was rightfully owed. Now, that is one of the rare things where it is written up, because usually, as you rightly say, men write history, or history is written for men. And the other thing about it too is it was only the wealthy. You don't have any idea about... So that wealthy 1%, we know something about, and we know it's distorted because they will only say what they want you to hear, and it'll be men. So as for women, let alone poor women, there is very little known until way after the printing press and people learning to read and write a bit more.
Exactly, exactly. Now, women... As I know, well, I know you've written this book because you obviously do adore women. Do you think women have more wisdom than men?
I think they have a different wisdom. I think theirs is... I think whilst men's is probably two-dimensional and black and white, women's is probably three-dimensional and coloured. We are very... I don't know, we... As I say, we're very two-dimensional. If you had a number of women in a lifeboat and a number of men in a lifeboat having to leave the sinking ship, if you then were able to look at those people a week later, you'd find that the men would know each other's golf handicap, which football team they liked. You'd know their ideal garage of cars and perhaps which film star they fancied. The women, meanwhile, wouldn't know anything like that about each other, but they know all about their families, they know about how they felt about things.
They were in a menopause, whether they had babies.
Exactly, and that is the difference.
Yeah.
And this
and
is
we
what
talk about it immediately as well.
Yes.
No hold bars, can't they?
Yes, I think that is very much the case, and this is why I think I find most men's conversations pretty boring, to be honest, because it is about work, football, cricket, golf, whatever. Mm. But see, I also think, and this is, I'm sticking my head in a noose here, there's going to be a gang of men outside waiting for me. But I think, as we were saying earlier about women controlling how children are brought up, the next thing they have control over, it is, and we are generalising, of course, women who decide which house you're going to live in.
Yeah. Which car you're going to buy.
Exactly. What the soft furnishings are going to be, what the hard furnishings are going to be.
Yeah, like all the interiors of this house.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where you go on holiday, who's coming at Christmas, where you're going, you know.
Yeah.
All this sort of thing is organised. So the man spends his time at work, and traditionally that was a long, hard day, and certainly for manual workers, it certainly was until the last 50 years. And so there is this culture of the men come home from work, they would often stop in the pub as a light relief. They would then get back to this environment, which was actually alien to them, and to a woman who, whilst they'd gone through a courting, mating ritual and the two had fitted together reasonably then, they were speaking different languages. And that has continued. So I think this is possibly one of the reasons that so many men go off and play golf, go to football, do gardening, whatever, is because they find themselves, when they're not at work, in an alien environment, and it doesn't feel good.
So you think that men need to get away from women?
I think that's what they choose to do because the way they have been brought up. I don't think any of this is malicious. You know, people talk about men hating women. Well, I don't think men hate women. Even those
so
that
why
beat...
do so say if these men are going off and doing the football match and everything, why do they want to come home to a wife? Is it they need love, don't they? Isn't it down to love?
Absolutely, because they received that when they were children. But their later upbringing, and even their upbringing when they were younger, allows love at a level, but not at another level. So the way you treat boys and girls, everyone does it. And I've spent years watching this happening. A little boy falls over, it's get up, brush your knees off, you're all right, carry on. A little girl does it, she's picked up, she's cuddled, she's costed. And this has an effect back to this thing of actions having reactions in the brain. This has been going on forever, so we can't expect it to change. It's not right to, but it is right to talk about it and say, do we want to change it? And I think it's women that want to change it more than men, or know that they do. I think some men want to change it. But until we sit down and have civilised conversation, and it'll be millions of conversations over decades, things ain't going to change an awful lot.
Tale of the Tigress by David Devere is published by Backdoor Publishing. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous Man Week.
Thank you very much for having me. Let the discussion continue.
I'm just an old-fashioned girl with an old-fashioned mind. Not sophisticated, I'm the plain and simple kind. I want an old-fashioned house with an old-fashioned fence and an old-fashioned millionaire. I'd like a plain, simple car, a cerise Cadillac, long enough to have a bowling alley in the back. I want an old-fashioned house with an old-fashioned fence and an old-fashioned millionaire. I'll stay weaving at my loom, be no trouble to my groom, if he'll keep the piles of money mounting. In our cottage there will be a soundproof nursery, not to wake the baby while I'm counting. I like the old-fashioned flowers, violets are for me, have them made in diamonds by the man at Tiffany. I want an old-fashioned house with an old-fashioned fence and an old-fashioned millionaire. Just a pilgrim at heart, oh so pure and genteel. Catch me in Las Vegas when I'm at the spinning wheel. I want an old-fashioned house with an old-fashioned fence and an old-fashioned millionaire. I'll ask for such simple things when my birthday occurs, two apartment buildings that are labeled hers and hers. I want an old-fashioned house with an old-fashioned fence and an old-fashioned millionaire. I like Chopin and Bizet and the songs of yesterday, string quartets and Polynesian carols. But the music that excels is the sound of oil wells as they slurp, slurp, slurp into the barrels. My little home will be quaint as an old parasol, and instead of carpets, I'll have money wall to wall. I want an old-fashioned house with an old-fashioned fence and an old-fashioned millionaire.
This is a Radio Gorgeous production for Radio Gorgeous 2017. For more information, go to radiogorgeous.com.